McGrath. Coming up on 10 past 8, The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next. Support for The Morning Show comes from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, offering a research-based master's degree in biological sciences covering diverse topics from ecology to molecular biology. With a 90% placement rate, become a leader in a science field that is shaping the future. Details available at uwp.edu. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today we are celebrating the birthday of Abraham Lincoln by going to the archives and replaying portions of three morning show interviews from the past, which were related in one way or another to our 16th president. And we begin with best-selling author Ronald C. White and one of the most highly regarded biographies of Lincoln, titled simply, A. Lincoln, A Biography. We recorded this interview back in 2009, the bicentennial year of Lincoln's birth.
I want to get what might sound like an amazingly mundane question out of the way. When you were given this opportunity to write a full-length biography of Abraham Lincoln, how is it determined just how lengthy a biography it would be? And, at some point, does that question get answered fairly arbitrarily? I should think that would make a really big difference in how you approach the task at hand.
Well, there's a funny answer to that question. I miscalculated. I made a mistake in my calculation between what we might call the typed page and the printed page. So as we were getting towards the end, my editor said, "Well, you're writing about a 700-page biography." I said, "Oh no, it's only 450 or 500 pages." So I became very worried. But then the publisher asked Jim McPherson, our finest Civil War historian, to give his evaluation, and he came in with a wonderful evaluation. And the publisher said, "Yes, we really do want to publish this full-length biography. We're happy to do so." So it turned out all right in the end.
So tell us what a historian has at their disposal when they want to examine someone like Abraham Lincoln, someone who has already been thoroughly examined, of course, by many writers before you, writers whom you generously acknowledge in your book, by the way. For you, what was most valuable?
Well, certainly the papers of Abraham Lincoln were published in the 1950s, but what might surprise people in the audience, it surprised me, really, or how many new papers of Abraham Lincoln have been found just in the last 10 or 15 years. For example, the papers of all of our presidents are in the Library of Congress, but someone got into their head about 7-8 years ago, "Well, I wonder if there's any papers still in the National Archives, you know, filed correctly or incorrectly in the various departments of the administration," and they found upwards of 100 of them. A woman walked into the Abraham Lincoln bookshop 5 years ago with a paper letter written to her great-great-grandfather, who was a Republican congressman. Often people show up with letters, but they're not authentic, but this was authentic. Then a team of researchers went out and scoured the courthouses of Illinois and found hundreds and hundreds of Lincoln legal documents, so that only in the last few years have they put together the Lincoln legal collection of more than 5,000 Lincoln legal cases, which gives us a whole new window, which I try to use in my biography, of Lincoln the lawyer and how that figures into Lincoln the president.
You mentioned at the beginning of the book that Lincoln did not keep a journal. And of course, we mourn the fact, because what a fascinating document that would be. But you say that he did, in a sense, keep a diary. It's just that it was never bound together, but with literally hundreds of different notes that he wrote over the course of the years that in some ways served as a depository for much of his thinking and reflection on various issues. Talk for a moment about these notes and to what extent they were of value to you, as they perhaps have been to other writers as well.
Yes, this to me is becoming a kind of central way that I'm finding readers are kind of getting a fresh way into Lincoln. Picture this, Lincoln would take little scraps of paper, sometimes the back of a flap of an envelope, and he would start writing notes to himself. He always began with a problem, slavery, the Dred Scott decision, the problem of secession, the birth of the Republican Party, or the problem of religion. And then he would kind of muse about this, reflect about it, stand almost walking around it, coming up with different angles. Then he would try to come to some sort of resolution. Many of these were unknown during his lifetime and found only after his death. They're in the collected works of Lincoln, but they're all separated. There's more than 100 of them. And I tried to see how this is almost Lincoln's intellectual diary. It's the way he defines himself, and I argue the way he ultimately will define America and even redefine America. They're the key, almost the private Lincoln behind the public Lincoln.
Talk for a moment about the challenge of separating fact from fiction, or maybe what's maybe a better way to put it when we talk about Abraham Lincoln is fact from myth. When we're even hearing from people who knew him and are writing about very direct encounters with him, but the fact that because Lincoln has become this towering figure, how possible is it for us to really discern exactly what happened in the presence of Lincoln, or exactly the things he did, or exactly the things he said?
Well, this is a great problem. We call it reminiscence. People would remember their conversations with Lincoln. It's as if you suddenly had gone to high school with Barack Obama, and now it's 25 or 40 years later, and you say, oh, we were great friends, and I remember he said to me. So one has to be very careful. Some books on Lincoln, without naming any of them, are not so careful. So whenever there was a doubt, I usually said, I can't use that as much as I'd like to use it. Well, there are some tests. How recently was it done? Was it done in 1865 or 1895? Did more than one person corroborate this particular story or this remembrance? Is the person who does the remembering generally trustworthy? For example, Ward Hill Lamon was his law partner. He's the one who said, well, Lincoln told me right after the Gettysburg Address, right on the platform, that speech won't scour. Well, did he really? Everybody asks about the great dream that Lincoln had when he woke up in the White House shortly before his death, heard crying and moaning, and was told there was the president had been killed, and he walked over to see. Well, Lincoln never said that. Ward Hill Lamon said Lincoln said that, and Lamon is not a very trustworthy witness. So those are the sorts of things that one has to sift very, very carefully.
I guess one of the things that is especially intriguing and probably frustrating to historians like yourself is the fact that there is a fair amount of uncertainty about some of the details of Lincoln's early life. Talk for a moment about Lincoln's own reticence in terms of talking about the earliest part of his life.
Lincoln was reticent. In 1860, it was the fashion in campaigns where the campaigner, the candidate, didn't campaign. Lincoln did not speak during the 1860 campaign. But there were like 37 campaign biographies written of him, and so there is one major kind of biography in which Lincoln contributed an autobiographical statement. And this is where he said, there really isn't much to say about my early life. This is kind of Lincoln's reticence, his self-deprecation. However, after his death, William Herndon, his law partner, set about to interview all of the people who had knew him as a young person. For a long time, people cast somewhat doubt upon this because, again, the question of reminiscence. But recently, these have been all pulled together in a wonderful volume called Herndon's Informants, and now you can begin to see, again, that's the question, did multiple people who knew Lincoln, say, in Indiana, remember this incident, remember these words of Lincoln? And so I think they've now achieved a greater value, even though they're way behind, many years before, there is value in these remembrances of Lincoln.
In the chapter called Undistinguished Families, where you piece together not only Lincoln's own childhood, but actually the generations that came just before him, one interesting choice you make is that sometimes in the midst of your text, we will see a signature of some of Lincoln's ancestors. I wonder if you would just speak a moment about that choice.
Well, Lincoln called his family undistinguished, and I think he saw his ancestors back through the prism of his father, with whom he had a conflicted relationship. I try to argue that his relationship with his forebears was more complex than is usually thought. He candidated as a self-made man. He was very curious, however, in private to find out more about his ancestors, but he could not reach back behind the ones that came from Virginia to Pennsylvania, from Pennsylvania to Virginia. So I tell the story of these ancestors who were rather distinguished. And therefore, each time that signature occurs, it's kind of a living reminder of these very real people, sort of the DNA, if you want to say, of the seven generations of Lincoln in America.
One of the most remarkable stories, which I do not remember hearing before, although surely it has been told before. I know it has, except somehow the story had not ever quite crossed my path, is of what happened to Lincoln's grandfather, and especially what nearly happened to Lincoln's father. And when one thinks about this particular event just playing out ever so slightly differently, we might not have had Abraham Lincoln, our 16th president, at all. Tell our listeners about this amazing incident.
Well, Lincoln's grandfather, Abraham Lincoln, probably following the allure of Daniel Boone and his coming into Kentucky, took that path himself with his family. They settled near what is presently Louisville. People lived near stockades. There was a battle going on between Native Americans who felt that these people were taking away their lands. And one afternoon, while Abraham, only age 41, was out planting some corn with his three sons, a Shawnee warrior came out of the woods and killed the father. It killed the grandfather, Abraham Lincoln. The two boys who were 14 and 16, or 12 and 14, fled. The youngest boy, Thomas, stayed by his father, sobbing. The 16-year-old went back to the stockade, grabbed a rifle, shot at the pendant around the Indian's neck, and killed him with one shot, and as you're suggesting, saved Thomas, Lincoln's father.
He is an intriguing figure, that is Thomas Lincoln, the future president's father. And you point out a couple of different things about why he is viewed the way he is. One of them is that Abraham Lincoln himself at some point seemed to sort of distance himself from his own father, but also the fact that historians, in talking about Lincoln in an effort to venerate him, would sometimes go to great lengths to sort of denigrate Thomas Lincoln, that the more unlikely we make Abraham Lincoln's origins, the more amazing figure he becomes, even if in the bargain you end up really giving great unjust insult to Thomas Lincoln.
You say it well, yes. I think it's exactly that. As we want to elevate Abraham, we denigrate the father, and I try to show that the picture of the father needs to be much more complex. The witnesses who remembered the father, the friends, have varying reports. Some reported very positively upon him, that if you looked at the tax rolls of Hardin County in Kentucky, for example, he was high up on those tax rolls in terms of the property that he owned. He was a man of a sense of humor, not surprising that the son would have a sense of humor. He was a member of the church. He helped build the church in Indiana. On the other hand, Abraham struggled with him because the father did not understand, I think, and maybe this is understandable, his son's intellectual curiosity. This young, strapping, strong boy who he wanted to become a farmer was often much more interested in reading books And so this became the source of the conflict between father and son.
Right. And, of course, if we're not careful, in your words, we look at Thomas Lincoln through the lens of history, often filtered in dark and disapproving colors.
That's right. Yeah.
I love that line. And I this is how you describe Lincoln's devotion to the idea of his of education and learning. You said early on, no matter how bleak and limiting life on his family's farm became, Abraham Lincoln learned to rely on his books and his imagination to satisfy his curiosity and intellect. I mean, I think that really helps us understand why he went to the lengths that he did, even though his circumstances allowed him very, very little in the way of formal education. But Abraham Lincoln was really, you tell us, tireless in his efforts to sow his own imagination and to find stimulation wherever he could.
I want audiences to remember, not all do, that that Lincoln had less than 1 year of formal education. But he had this drive for self-education, and this drive didn't end when he was 20 or 23 or 25. It continued all through his life. Many of us today may be the beneficiaries of a fine college education, but the real question is, what are we doing in our 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s to continue that education? And here Lincoln is a fascinating model.
You tell us that the little schooling that he did was in a school that might be called a blab school.
Yes.
Tell us why they were called that.
Well, because they, in a sense, blabbed the lessons. They would repeat the lessons out loud. They would memorize the lessons. And although, again, from our perspective, as we have sort of given up on memorization, be it Shakespeare, the Gettysburg Address, or the Bible, I think some years ago I used to think, well, this is just rote memory. But look at it from a different angle. This was the platform, or if you will, the foundation by which one could then begin to think in later years about the meaning of the Bible or the meaning of Shakespeare. So Lincoln committed all of these classic texts to memory, which was part of the way schooling took place.
Hmm. And of course, he eventually is an amazingly well-read young man. And you quote one of his friends, Nathaniel Grigsby, as saying, "He was different from those around him. His mind soared above us." What a beautiful way to put it.
Isn't that wonderful? That was maybe his closest friend. They went to school together, and this man recognized this difference in Lincoln from the other boys.
Ronald C. White's biography of our 16th president is titled A Lincoln, A Biography. It was published back in 2009, the bicentennial year of Lincoln's birth. You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Next, historian Lewis Lehrman and his extraordinary book, Lincoln at Peoria, The Turning Point, which examines a dramatic anti-slavery speech which Lincoln delivered on October 16, 1854, in Peoria, Illinois. It seemed to signal a dramatic turnaround in Lincoln's understanding of slavery and the importance of ending it.
You mentioned that this seems to be, in many respects at least, the first time that Lincoln forcefully declared his opposition on moral grounds to slavery. At one point, for instance, you say Lincoln's 1854 anti-slavery speeches were the first major dissertations on a subject which would dominate the rest of his life. Ahead of 1854, it's not that he never talked about slavery. How much did he touch on this topic ahead of 1854, and in what way does his treatment of this issue change in Peoria?
Greg, you're right on the money in quoting the phrase, his first major dissertations on anti-slavery, because as you imply, he had been anti-slavery in his political maturity before this. One example was in the state legislature, almost entirely alone. One other colleague, a chap by the name of Dan Stone, he and Stone in 1837 registered a dissent from a virtually unanimous resolution of the Illinois state legislature, and in their protest, they declared slavery to be bad policy and also unjust. Lincoln also had expressed his anti-slavery opinions during his by voting in 1848. In 1848, when he arrived in Congress for his short two-year period, voting for the Wilmot Proviso, which was a provision that had been proposed by a Pennsylvania Democrat to prohibit slavery in all of the territory acquired from Mexico after the Mexican War, which was a vast territory extending the United States to the Pacific. So there, and there are other many cases where he registered his attitude toward anti-slavery. In fact, he said, in my entire life, I've never known a moment when I was not anti-slavery. Still, this speech at Peoria on October 16th was the first major dissertation. And major it was, Greg. It was 17,300 words long and lasted for 3 hours and 10 minutes. And it followed a speech that very afternoon by Senator Douglas, which itself was pro-Kansas-Nebraska Act, essentially pro-slavery, or that lasted 3 hours. So the thousands of people who attended on the day of October 16th to hear these speeches by a very prominent Whig and the most prominent Democrat in America were standing with a break for dinner for as much as 7 hours in order to hear the pros and cons of the slavery issue.
I mean, that in itself is sort of an extraordinary thing to acknowledge, the fact that we are talking about a time and place in which the way ideas were shared and talked about and disseminated and digested was so profoundly different from the way things are now. I mean, the thought of sitting and listening to anybody give a three-hour speech about anything, I mean, is just unfathomable to us.
It was said by observers, Greg, just to reinforce that observation, that not only was the crowd numbering in the thousands, but the crowd augmented itself as the afternoon and the dinner break occurred. The dinner break occurred at 5 o'clock after Senator Douglas finished his three-hour speech, primarily because Mr. Lincoln stood up, who was scheduled to answer Douglas, and he said, "Look, I'd like you all to go out and take a break, have dinner, and come back here at 7 o'clock." And since Mr. Lincoln believed the majority of the crowd were pro-Douglas, he said, "I want you to come back just for the pleasure of hearing Senator Douglas skin me, because he has the right to respond," which Douglas did. So it was Douglas in the afternoon for 3 hours. It was Lincoln who stood up and said, "Let's have a break and then come on back here." They arrived at 7 o'clock. The crowd assembled. Lincoln spoke until shortly after 10 o'clock. Senator Douglas arose again, and for approximately a half hour or so, some say it was even longer, responded to Lincoln's 3 hour and 10 minute speech. And there they laid out the issues in the most sophisticated, rigorous, and controversial way that the reading of the speech can only convey how profound their penetration of this issue was.
Right. You include the incomplete text of the speech in Peoria, of Lincoln's speech, that is, and it's fascinating the many different points that he makes. One of them echoes rather eerily to our own day when he says right at the top in his introductory remarks, he says, I further wish to say that I do not propose to question the patriotism or to assail the motives of any man or class of men, but rather to strictly confine myself to the naked merits of the question. I mean, in a sense, that sounds like politicians will say to one another before they really have at it, except that so often those politicians in question do not confine themselves, in Lincoln's words, to the naked merits of the question. But that was something which, in this case, Lincoln really tried to do, not by smearing Stephen Douglas or painting him as a demon, but to apply himself logically and methodically to the issue in question itself.
Yes. That is an issue or a point that you make, Greg, that I dwell on at some length. President Lincoln's great characteristic that has been observed by those who like him and those who don't like him during the Civil War was his magnanimous disposition, the magnanimity, a very difficult virtue to attain for anybody, which was displayed during the war and, of course, at the end of the war with malice toward none, with charity for all. But this magnanimous characteristic we see first displayed in its most dramatic way in what, for the most part, has been an obscure speech, this Peoria speech, where, as you quote, he begins his speech by saying he's not going to assail the motives of any man or any class of men. And, of course, he's especially speaking of Senator Douglas and those who were pro-slavery, because Lincoln did realize that America itself at that time was not only in a large part the home of 4 million black slaves, but it was also racist north of the Ohio River and north of the Mason-Dixon line. And Lincoln goes on to emphasize in subsequent speeches that both Northerners and Southerners are responsible for this terrible blot on a republic dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. So here we see magnanimity displayed by Lincoln in the very onset of this great speech, and he sticks to it throughout.
Hmm. One of the most powerful statements he makes is when he talks about slavery as being something monstrous. He says, I cannot help but hate slavery. I hate it because of the monstrous injustice of slavery itself. I hate it because it deprives our Republican example of its just influence in the world, enables the enemies of free institutions with plausibility to taunt us as hypocrites, causes the real friends of freedom to doubt our sincerity, and especially because it forces so many really good men amongst ourselves into an open war with the very fundamental principles of civil liberty, criticizing the Declaration of Independence and insisting that there is no right principle of action but self-interest. I mean, those are strong words indeed.
And words which evoke so many controversies of the day. There is a pervasive cynicism in politics, around politics, and as people, the average citizen, thinks of politics, that self-interest is the sole motivation by which you can really judge men and women. And the truth is that there are men and there are women who, through conscious reflection and rational argument and deep study, arrive at principles by which they wish to guide their lives, either in religion or in political philosophy. And Mr. Lincoln had arrived at the point in his life where he was going to be guided by the Declaration of Independence and the proposition that all men are created equal, unto, in fact, as it turned out, the 13th Amendment in 1865 and the abolition of slavery. And he would do that even at the risk of his life, which he knew at all times during the war. Those who he dismissed as guards and protectors, he was going to do that even at the risk of his life. And, of course, in the end, he did give his life. That the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, which guaranteed a republic based on the Declaration of Independence, might pass.
One thing that is interesting, for as mightily as he rails against slavery itself, he is also practical in that he, and honest, in that he admits his own reservations, or at least says that he has certain reservations, that he would not necessarily suggest that in one fell swoop all the slaves be completely freed and returned to their homeland and all be completely changed. I mean, he acknowledges the complexity of what exactly to do with the slaves. He says at one point, "I think I would not hold one in slavery at any rate, yet the point is not clear enough for me to denounce people upon. What next? Free them and make them politically and socially our equals? My own feelings will not admit of this, and if mine would, we well know that those of the great mass of white people will not. Whether this feeling accords with justice and sound judgment is not the sole question, if indeed it is any part of it. A universal feeling, whether well or ill-founded, cannot be safely disregarded. We cannot then make them equals. It does seem to me that systems of gradual emancipation might be adopted." I mean, that is really interesting honesty on Abraham Lincoln's part, that we see him as more than just someone idealistically pursuing the moral high ground here. He is thinking about practical matters of things like implementation and of implementing such a change in the face of what is likely to be widespread misgivings among the public.
I insist in the book on the importance of that quotation, among the other excellent ones that you cited, because there are two aspects to this man that make him probably the greatest statesman of history. First was the fact that he was driven by a set of principles and was not prepared to repudiate them under any circumstances, even at the risk of secession and civil war. But the second thing, the second aspect of him was he displayed not only a philosophic wisdom of the highest sort, but a practical and prudential wisdom. And it gets right to this point that a universal sentiment a universal prejudice among the people in a democratic society cannot be safely disregarded. In Illinois, in 1854, most historians agree that this was the most racist free state in the North. With all respect for the great people of Illinois, the evidence seems overwhelming that Illinois was the most racist of the free states before the Civil War. And Mr. Lincoln knew that nobody who proposed immediate abolition could ever be elected to public office. So the only way that he could advance his cause and be elected so that he could do something about it was to attempt a prudential solution. And his solution was to advocate that slavery should be put in the course of ultimate extinction. His phrase, and I quote it directly, slavery should be put in the course of ultimate extinction, whereas abolition was impossible because no group of legislators would come together to endorse it, and no politician campaigning on such a doctrine, except in a very few small places in New England, could ever get elected on that, much less never get elected in Illinois. So he was able to weave his way through a North which was racist, Illinois which was very racist, as an upholder of the proposition that all men are created equal, while at the same time assuring the constituency, both pro-slavery and anti-slavery in Illinois, that his view was that slavery should be put in the course of ultimate extinction because it was bad for both the slaveholders, and it was bad for the slaves themselves, and it was bad for the free whites who dominated the electorate at the time.
Another interesting point I want to mention. He is trying to connect with those who would hold slaves and maybe get them thinking about it without, of course, as I said, calling them evil demons. One of the most interesting questions that he brings up is the fact that within the United States, including the District of Columbia, there are 433,000-plus free blacks. At $500 per head, they are worth over $200 million. How comes this vast amount of property to be running about without owners? We do not see free horses or free cattle running at large. How is this? All these free blacks are the descendants of slaves, or have been slaves themselves, and they would be slaves now, but for something which has operated on their white owners, inducing them at vast pecuniary sacrifices to liberate them. What is that something? Is there any mistaking it? In all these cases, it is your sense of justice and human sympathy continually telling you that the poor Negro has some natural right to himself, that those who deny it and make mere merchandise of him deserve kickings, contempt, and death. I mean, I think that is some really masterful thinking on Abraham Lincoln's part to help certain slave owners or those sympathetic to them a way to for them to call those beliefs into question, to re-examine them.
Yes, well, Greg, you certainly have read the book with great care, and you may remember that right after this quotation to which you refer, I point out that these were very hard words. Here he's saying those who repudiate the Negro's inalienable right to liberty, that is to say, to ownership of himself or herself, deserve kickings and even death.
I mean, the end is hard.
This is a
hard.
Very challenging set of remarks to make in that particular historical context. And if I may ask you to forbear just for 1 second, one of the reasons that he presses this case is that the slaveholders had developed a view beginning as early as the 18th century that slaves were entirely chattels. They were property, no different, and the ownership of a slave was tantamount to the same thing as owning a horse or a steer or a cow. And Lincoln's using the metaphor which you just described. How is it that we see all these free blacks running around without we don't see free horses and free cattle and free steers running around doing freely what they please? He was attempting to, with a metaphor, repudiate the idea that a slave was not 100% a human being as much as any white man, but that, in fact, the white men who had been slaveholders recognized this in the freeing of them.
Lewis Lerman is author of Lincoln at Peoria, The Turning Point. We finish out this birthday tribute to Abraham Lincoln with Philip Kunhardt III, co-author of an amazing book called Looking for Lincoln, The Making of an American Icon. This fascinating book actually begins with the assassination of Lincoln in 1865 and culminates with the dedication of the Lincoln Memorial in 1922. The book traces our nation's efforts to come to terms with the assassination of Lincoln and how Americans came to a new understanding of Lincoln and his significance. Your book is also remarkable in how it brings to life important occasions in which Lincoln was commemorated over the years, as well as other important events such as the great reunion event at Gettysburg, the centennial of his birth, which you've already touched on. One interesting event which occurred in, I believe, 1878, and I don't remember now what exactly that occasion was, but you call it, the headline is, an uneasy commemoration, because for that special event, oh, it was a dedication of Lincoln and his cabinet reading the Emancipation Proclamation.
Oh, yeah, the Carpenter painting.
Yes, but for this event, the two people brought in to speak are James Garfield and mm-hmm. Alexander Stephens, the vice president of the Confederacy.
Right.
And And apparently it was an event of some awkwardness and tension. But it says so much about the state of our nation at that point in time, that that we still were a nation just sort of barely knit together after the war, which had split us apart.
You're absolutely right. And this, increasingly, beginning in the 1870s, you know, the failure of Reconstruction is often placed at the year 1876, which was the year of that Hayes's election. And I think the years in the late 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, the country was increasingly fixated on mending the breach between North and South that had continued. And the racial issues of racial justice that had been raised during Lincoln's administration and during the 10 years after his death were pushed off to the back burner, and because they didn't feel they could do both. They couldn't reconcile North and South plus solve the racial issues the way they had tried in the first 10 years of Reconstruction. It had failed, and they decided it was more important to heal the sectional divide than it was to solve the racial problems. Hmm. And so you see increasingly this event you mentioned is a sign of exactly this new trend. You see more and more of this as time goes on, until by the time of the dedication of the Lincoln Memorial in 1922, there is virtually no mention at all of race or slavery or emancipation. It's all about the reunion of North and South. All the imagery on the Lincoln Memorial is about that. And the one black speaker of the day has his text heavily censored by the commission on the memorial, so that he can't lay out any kind of real challenge to the country.
It is 10 o'clock, and this is Morning Classics for Thursday, the 22nd of January, 2009.
I think of all of the remarkable photographs that are in this book, among them a couple of beautiful pictures of Frederick Douglass that I'd never seen before that I especially love. And for our Milwaukee listeners, a picture of a very young Golda Meir involved in some kind of event in the early 20th century, another touching photograph of young school children gathered around a famous statue of Lincoln. But I think my favorite photograph of all is a very old, tattered photograph on page 80 in your book, which shows a group of teachers sitting in front of the old Lincoln cabin in Indiana. Mm-hmm. You tell us that this was the start of what now is a very familiar tradition of going to some famous place and having your picture taken standing in front of it, something we take for granted now, but of course quite uncommon then. And there is something about looking at this picture. I mean, we can barely make out what it is. It's such an old, primitive photograph, but it tells us how soon after Lincoln's death, he is already held in a very special sort of esteem, that it would mean enough for people to seek out the place where he had once lived.
Oh, yeah. I agree with you. I think I'm so pleased you call attention to that. And yeah, this was one of his houses. And the other, all the places where Lincoln lived soon became objects of interest to the public. His birth cabin in Kentucky, and of course his home in Springfield, where he lived, the only house he ever owned, and other log cabins associated with his family, his father's log cabin in Goose Nest Prairie, for example. And tourists would begin seeking these places out because they would feel that in proximity to these physical locations, they could somehow draw near to the memory of Lincoln himself. Eventually these became more formalized, and states would actually make parks out of these places and put money into them and build roads to them. And you saw an increasing attention to what they called the Lincoln Shrines. They're no longer called shrines because that's considered too almost quasi-religious a term. But that's what they were for a long time. They were shrines where people came to meditate on the past, on the meaning of the past, and on the example the heroic example of this man who stood at the center of our country's history and presided over the end of slavery, which is the great contradiction in our history. So these shrines, they're now called sites, which is not quite as evocative, but a little more secular, I suppose.
Hmm. One of the remarkable little facts we learn along the way is that one of these log cabins was essentially lost or disappeared after it was on display at the World Exposition in Chicago. Do I remember that correctly?
Yeah, that, I'm trying to remember. Yes, I'm trying to remember which cabin this was. Now, there are a lot of cabin stories. Was this the one that Dennis Hanks was attached to?
I'm trying to remember, but. But and of course, you're right, too, that some of these, it's like, well, which cabin is this, and is this really what it is? And there is some question that surrounds some of these structures.
Well, one of the cabins was purchased and moved to Chicago, where it was on display for some time, and I think that's the one you're referring to. And it was a cabin that Lincoln may have helped build. I don't believe he ever lived there, but the fact it was attached to his memory and his family made it of interest to the people. And unfortunately, it was not cared for well, and it disappeared from sight. The cabin that's on display in Kentucky has an interesting history as well. I mean, that has some dubious provenance to it. The house that Lincoln grew up in, or was born in and grew up in, his first short years of life, probably disappeared. I mean, I think when travelers went to find it, it wasn't there. Some decades after his death, but it had been moved to it had been bought by a neighbor, and the boards used for other purposes, and somehow some entrepreneur was able to buy them back and reconstruct the cabin, and then it went on a great tour of the country, and eventually it was bought by a group of concerned citizens who thought it should be saved, and it was it was rebuilt and dedicated in 1909 by Theodore Roosevelt. And today it sits inside a great marble temple, and you go inside and you see what is the purported to be the very cabin in which Lincoln was born.
A log cabin sitting in the middle of a marble temple.
Yeah.
Interesting contradictions. I want to mention one last thing.
Yeah.
It's a fascinating story about the immediate aftermath of the assassination and Mary Todd Lincoln actually being allowed to remain in the White House for, I think you tell us, 5 weeks before she finally finds herself able to literally move on. But that in that time, as she is shut away, virtually a recluse on the top floor of the White House, that there are all kinds of people who come into the executive mansion and loot it, wanting to carry off one sort of memento or another. I mean, in a sense, although your book takes the long view of how the country's veneration of Lincoln gradually took shape, I mean, in a sense, in those days immediately after the assassination, we already see an incredible fascination with who he was and an almost desperate desire to make him part of us.
Well, that's very eloquently put. And I think you're right. John Hay once said he soared almost instantly into the panoply of the people's memory and affection. And, you know, he had already grown in stature during his lifetime. And they had grown to, most in the North had grown to love him and revere him during the last few years of his life. And his assassination just catapulted him into this position.
Philip Kunhardt III is co-author of Looking for Lincoln, The Making of an American Icon. I'm Gregory Berg. And Monday on The Morning Show, I'm excited to share with you an interview I have recorded with Rob Rapley, director, producer, and writer of the next American Experience documentary airing on PBS, and this called Voice of Freedom. This documentary chronicles the dramatic
recital that Marian Anderson sang on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial on Easter Sunday, April 9th, 1939, and paints a rich historical context in which that recital took place. You can hear that conversation on Monday's Morning Show. Support for the Morning Show comes from the University of Wisconsin, Parkside, offering a research-based master's degree in biological sciences covering a diverse topics from ecology to molecular biology with a 90% placement rate. Become a leader in